Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There had been abuse in my family, but it was mostly musical in nature.
Are you ready to get your world rocked?
Ready!
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Do it!
1, 2, 3, 4!
Roseanne Cash had big shoes to fill as Johnny Cash's daughter, so instead she ended up walking her own path. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. Stay tuned for a special interview and performance with Roseanne Cash, recorded live at WXPN in Philadelphia. And later, we'll review a new album from another singer-songwriter, Jenny Lewis. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. This is Sound Opinions, and we're going to dive into our interview and performance by Roseanne Cash later. And every once in a while, I'd be flashing on top of this, who her father was.
Yeah, Jim, it's quite a legacy, and a daunting one, in that I think she's been reluctant to talk about Johnny for many decades. And only recently, as she started to talk about Johnny and sort of get into some of the details of their life together. We're going to get some of that later on in the show. But first, we've got some music news. That's Still Alive and Well from Johnny Winter, the great blues guitarist, Texas-bred blues guitarist, who died at the age of 70 a few days ago while on the road in Europe. It was apt that he died on tour. He never really stopped, even though he was in ill health. Johnny Winter's career stretches back to the mid-60s, when he started playing rock and roll out of Texas, discovered the blues soon after, and became a huge blues acolyte ever after. In fact, when you talk about the vocabulary of the blues rock guitar, I think Johnny Winter is at the very top of that list. Famous for a number of reasons, he and his brother, younger brother, Edgar, had a number of hits in the 70s. Edgar probably outdid him from a commercial standpoint, but Johnny was no slouch when it came to making big records. All of his records in the 70s sold fairly well. He recorded a track called Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo that introduced not only him to a wider public, but his guitar player, Rick Derringer, who went on to have a hit with that song.
Yeah, rock and roll, hoochie-coo. Lord and mama, not a few. Rock and roll, hoochie-coo. Shook on
Winter continued to record and also produce in that decade. One of the things I think that was maybe given short shrift when people talked about Johnny Winter's death was the key role he had in the comeback of one of his heroes, Muddy Waters. He produced three key Muddy Waters albums beginning in the late 70s with Hard Again that really brought Waters back into the limelight shortly before Waters' own death. One of the tracks from that era, Mannish Boy, a cover of a song that Waters had performed in the 50s, you can hear Winter all over it as a producer, guitar player, but also just as a foil, a vocal foil, an enthusiastic vocal foil for what Muddy Waters was doing.
This is Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's the song A Feather's Not a Bird by our guest this week, Roseanne Cash. Now that last name gives it away, right? Roseanne's the daughter of music legend Johnny Cash. And being born into music has given the singer-songwriter special insight into the business. But Nashville proved to be more full of friction than family ties and forced her to abandon country music and craft her own sound, unbound by any category.
Now on her 13th solo album, The River and the Thread, Roseanne and husband John Leventhal tried to capture all the geographic places that gave special meaning to her life and music. Places like the Cash ancestral home in Virginia or Memphis, Tennessee. Some narratives are fictional, others draw from family lore. And Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal joined Greg and me, as well as a live studio audience at WXPN in Philadelphia, for a special performance of these new songs. They also talked about the Cash musical legacy, rock and roll's great river songs, and why there's no love lost between Roseanne and the country music establishment. We began by asking her about moving from writing personal songs to songs about a place.
So I'm going down to Florence just to learn to love the thread.
Well, the last record came out in 2010, and, you know, a couple years after that, we were touring for a while with it and started going, well, you know, I was writing some songs, John was writing some songs, but we weren't really interested in just recording the next 12 songs. We had gotten really interested in very old-fashioned concept records and themed albums with a single narrative and something that was really rooted in geography. And it so happened we started taking a lot of trips down south, and for various reasons. One reason, which is I was working with Arkansas State University to restore my dad's boyhood home. And one day driving through Osceola, Arkansas, we stopped and there's kind of a haunted, bleak little place. And John saw this sign and it said it was the home of Reggie Young and Albert King, right?
And Sun Seals.
And Sun Seals. So Reggie Young, you know, great, great guitar player from that whole Muscle Shoals group of musicians. And John said, you know, there's something here. And we started writing songs.
So, I mean, you knew some of these locales from your youth.
Sure.
But you're, for all intents and purposes, last two decades, you're a New Yorker.
23 years a New Yorker, yeah.
There you go. That's a New Yorker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this was rediscovering a place that, you know, I mean, only existed vaguely for you.
It was going down there with our hearts really open. You know, it's not like I hadn't been to the South a lot. But after leaving the South, I'd lived in Nashville only 9 years. And I just, every time I went down after that, my stomach kind of hurt when I got off the plane. Like, it just felt claustrophobic to me. And, you know, there's a very insular quality to the South and some people and places. And some of it's strange and beautiful and wonderful, and some of it does feel, you know, claustrophobic. So when we went down for the Dias Project, the Arkansas Project, around my dad's boy at home, going to Alabama to see my friend, Natalie Channon, and she taught me to sew. And as she was threading my needle one day, she said, "You have to love the thread." And it just, it brought tears to my eyes. She wasn't speaking metaphorically, but it brought tears to my eyes. And I thought, man, you have to love the thread.
So The River and the Thread, yes, is the title of the record. So it sounds like you didn't go down there with the idea, we're going to be inspired and write songs. It just sort of, those songs came to you as you were happening to do this other stuff that was part of your life.
No, we didn't say, let's go to the South and write an album. No, but once we were down there, as John said, we started to get inspired.
It's one thing to say, we're going to do an album about the South, and it's another thing to actually do it and have it mean something. So, I mean, I think we were both inspired by a couple of trips we took, and then we were thinking about it, and we dipped our toe in the creative waters, as it were, to see what it actually meant to us. And lo and behold, we discovered we were really inspired. It really led us to, you know, great places as songwriters.
I'm fascinated by this because, as you said, Roseanne, you've been living in New York for 23 years. You were born in Memphis, but you didn't spend a lot of time there initially in your life. It was California.
Right.
John, you're pretty much lifelong.
Yeah, born and bred.
New Yorker. So what is it about the, you know, I'm sort of getting this kind of John Fogerty, California kid, imagines what the South is like and writes these great Creedence songs about the feeling of the area. And it seems almost like in some ways it was like that with you guys getting down there.
I mean, I'm an
outsider. For him more than me. Yeah.
I mean, I'm definitely an outsider, but I've also been a professional musician, you know, for 40 years and have loved music since I was 10. So it's hard to have really loved popular music of the last half a century without somehow being fully influenced and aware of and sort of taken in the importance of music that's come from the Delta and Appalachia and New Orleans and various places. I mean, even though I grew up in New York, it's when I heard those songs, it's you couldn't help it. Like, where is that? What is that? Who are they? Why did they do this? Why are all these incredible songs coming from this one town called Memphis? I mean,
I can't underestimate how powerful it is to me now. I mean, I thought it was a footnote that my parents were both Southerners. And that I was born in Memphis. But to really feel those connections, it's not unique to me that, you know, in midlife we want to know where we came from, who we came from, what they were connected to, and so we can know ourselves better.
And isn't it weird, Roseanne, how when you go back to a place where you grew up, it looms large in your imagination. Then you say, wow, this place was so small.
Well, I didn't grow up there, but...
Right.
But... You're right. I went back and saw that seven children were raised in this tiny house and that FDR, the WPA, saved my family. They were so desperately poor. It just blows my mind that I'm a New Yorker and two generations back we were cotton farmers. It's, you know, my kids need to know that they are connected to that too.
Well, you've got your acoustic guitars. We're live here at WXBN with Roseanne Cash. You're going to play us. What are you guys going to play us?
This is really our story, John's story, my story of traveling around together and kind of keeping your eyes on each other to keep the course steady. This is called Modern Blue.
Went to Barcelona on the midnight train. Walked the streets of Paris in the pouring rain. I flew across an island in the northern sea. And I ended up in Memphis, Tennessee. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big wide world with a million shades of modern blue. Everybody around here moves too fast. head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big wide world with a million shades of mud and blue. Will you still be there when I round the curve? Will you hold my hand when I lose my nerve? Oh, I went to Barcelona and my mind got changed. So I'm heading back to Memphis on the midnight train. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big wide world. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. I keep my head down, I keep my eyes on you. It's a big wide world with a million shades of mud and blue.
That's Modern Blue from Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal on Sound Opinions. We're here in Philadelphia, WXPN. From the new album, The River and the Thread, a beautiful record, a concept record. You know, you brought that word up, Roseanne. I wasn't going to use that word. I know some artists don't want to hear it. Yeah, it's not an old, you know, it's a kind of an old-fashioned term, but I think we're all concept album lovers in this room, actually. But the love of concept albums. Where did that come from? Where do you remember hearing concept albums as a kid? Why was that maybe a cut above just hearing a song, you know, in a vacuum kind of thing?
From early childhood, I loved concept records. My favorite records of my dad's were the concept records, Bitter Tears, Ballads of the True West, even Orange Blossom Special. And as a teenager, you know, Tommy. And even Joni Mitchell's Blue, although not traditionally a concept record, it felt like one to me. They always just drew me in. I loved albums that had an arc of a single narrative.
I think we were intrigued by the idea of trying to create a world.
Yeah, a world. Yeah. That's
true. We're not pretending like we're creating an authentic world. We're just creating this kind of world that meant something to us of what we felt about the South and the people that we knew and the places that we loved. And
right, and to populate these songs with some real characters, too, was really exciting and kind of a challenge.
Well, because you've gotten that, you know, there was so much autobiographical confessional, people would say, you know, you were working things out in song for so long, that now to be able to write about other people, to create other characters, to tell other tales and myths, it's got to be liberating in a way.
Well, it was scary. John really pushed me on that from the beginning.
I was done with the autobiography.
No more.
You were what?
I said, no more autobiography.
You're just not that interesting, honey.
Well, here's the ironic truth. It's all autobiography. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
It really somehow is in a convoluted, elliptical way.
He did keep saying, don't write about your feelings. But of
save
course,
it for Twitter.
Save it for Twitter. Of
no,
course.
Let's not do that.
Yeah.
There, you know, the emotional resonance, whether it's my feelings or projected feelings or a character's feelings, you know, it's hopefully people relate to that. But writing about the real characters did make me feel a little self-conscious. But then once I slipped inside what I thought were their heads, it was thrilling.
What's the temperature, darling? 100 or more.
We'll have more with Roseanne Cash in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later, we're going to review the long-awaited new album from Postal Service and Rilo Kiley singer Jenny Lewis.
And I'll take the back wheel. We'll drive straight down the river road, spread a blanket on the hill. What's the temperature, darling? Now don't stare into the past. There was nothing we could change or fix. It was never gonna last. Now don't stare into those photos. Don't analyze my eyes. We're just a mile or two from Memphis and the rhythm of our lives. A mile or two from Memphis, and I must go away. I tore up all the highways. Now there's nothing left to say. I went to Barcelona on the midnight train. I walked the streets of Paris in the pouring rain.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and our guest this week is Roseanne Cash. We recorded this conversation in front of a Philadelphia audience at WXPN. And Roseanne played songs from her new album, The River and the Thread, a concept album about the South, a place that often gets mythologized in American music. Here, Roseanne explains why she chose to write about these Southern characters, both the ideal and the reality. What changed for you about the South as you were writing these songs?
Well, that is a really important topic, because we could have been Pollyannas about the South and only shine the light on the good parts of the music, you know? And there's been horrible violence and in the South that I didn't feel we could ignore, but then we thought, this is a record about this world, as John said, that we've created with these characters and these people. The music is so resonant to us, and every roots musician owes something to the Delta. This is the light where we're going to shine the light. You know, we don't have to get into everything else. It's not that I'm discounting
it. Well, we're not historians. We're not historians.
Yeah, we're not historians. That's true. And, you know, there are references made, you know, in World of Strange Design, just the prism that you look through, some people in the South look through, and how unique it can be. Beautiful, but very odd. And also, there's a reference to Emmett Till in Money Road, in the song Money Road, and that spot where the civil rights movement was sparked.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've told that story. So the what was it, a cafe where Till allegedly...
A grocery store.
Allegedly, yeah. Flirted with a white woman and right. Winds up in his death. Is, you know, and the Tallahatchie Bridge, yeah. And Robert Johnson's Crossroads, they're all there.
They're
right?
All there. In such close proximity, it blows your mind.
Yeah.
And you have no idea, and it's in the most haunted landscape, and it's not like there are hordes of tourists, you know. There's nothing there.
Mm-hmm. You can still get a feeling for how this place that we're talking about created all these incredible musicians. You know, from everybody, Muddy Waters, Helen Wolf, Johnny Cash, Bobby Gentry. I mean, for all the reasons you're just talking about, you drive down these roads and you can still get a sense it's 100 years ago, it's 150 years ago, it's 50 years ago. You can kind of feel what they may have felt in the air, you know, and get just a little bit of a, you know, part of the
time travel.
Yeah.
Were you guys going to play Muddy Road, perchance?
Sure.
Do you want us to do that now?
Sure. All right. I think that's great.
I was dreaming about the time. Tallahatchie Bridge, a thousand miles from where we live. But the long line at the pearly gate, the keepers of our fate, none of out on Money Road. A lonesome boy in a foreign land. guess we'll never understand. One lies in the Zion yard, and one sleeps on the river bar. Neither one got very far out on Money Road. Out on Money Road.
This is just too good for words, ain't it? John Leventhal, Roseanne Cash. We're thrilled to be here with them. At WXBN on Sound Opinions. So, Roseanne, I got a confession to make. Well, number one, I'm jealous as heck, because when you found out he was Greg Cotton and you've only ever talked to him on the, he got a big hug. He is now the coolest person in Philadelphia today.
You'll get one at the end of the show.
The songwriting process, you know, your evolution, Roseanne, has fascinated me. I mean, people may not remember, but 11, I think I got that right, 11 number one country hits in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty good record. And then you make a record in 1990, Interiors, where everything sort of changes. Country radio goes, what is this?
We don't want her no more.
And then soon after, you start working with John.
Yep.
And you've been working with John for 20 years now, to the point where now, if I understand this correctly, John, you wrote most of the music, almost all the music on
all
this record.
Music.
And Roseanne, you wrote
the
just
lyrics.
About all the lyrics.
Yeah.
That partnership. And John, I'd like you to speak to this. When you started working with Roseanne, what did you see there? Did you see it ending up here? No, right. Seriously. I mean, because, you know, you're not...
Someone was giving me a look, so I didn't hear the question.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, man. Yeah. I know what it feels like to work with your wife. It's got to be It's got to be tough.
But, so let's move on.
Yes, exactly. Let's skip these questions. Okay, everybody turn off your cell phones. This is strictly...
No, I have been asked this question many times.
Yeah.
I mean, when we first met, Roseanne was already very well established in Nashville, and I had been in New York. I not quite as well established, but I had made some records as a I'd been producing for a little bit in writing. I've always been a songwriter first. I always think of myself as a songwriter anyway. It's been a long and complicated and beautiful and challenging and exhilarating dance to kind of get to the place where we collaborated as much as we have on, I would say, the last two records. I think in the beginning, if this is what you're asking me, I was more probably, I'll be your producer. We did a little bit of co-writing, but Rose had her songs and I tried to find the best way. But she's kind of slowly let me, you know, infiltrate the songwriting thing, which is really my first love anyway. So it's been great, you know.
Well, it's been a great dovetail because I was not interested in co-writing in those years you were talking about. It was felt very territorial about my songs, and I didn't want to compromise, and I had a single vision. And the older I get, the more I want to collaborate. And it so happens that he's very good at things that I'm okay at. And, you know, and he's not really a lyric writer all the time, so it works out for us. I mean, that in itself is marriage. You bring your best selves and hope that it's something bigger.
Well, there is an audience now, right? And what's the relationship with Nashville, not the place, the industry, the mentality like now? Do you feel any connection?
No, I don't really have a relationship, and I don't say that pejoratively. I just, it's the commercial country music industry in Nashville is its own thing, you know, and I definitely a way outlier from that. But fortunately, you know, the Americana community has grown up, and as Emmylou Harris said, we were doing Americana before it had a name.
Mm, yeah.
But there's a real community there, and they've embraced us, and we have a lot of friends in it, and we love the music, so it's been a good forum.
You in a lot of ways, a lot of people call you a defining artist in that area. Even when you were having the so-called country hits, they said, well, this is really what Americana became. And that's what I was trying to get at a little bit, John, with you coming at the perspective of, you know, I've read some interviews with you where you've talked about, hey, I'm a Beatles guy. I'm coming from this perspective. So you're working with this so-called country artist. Did you feel like there was a way for you to work with what Roseanne already had established in a way that was like, okay, I can build on what she's doing? Or did it feel like you had to find a way in there?
Well, I definitely had to find a way in, but I don't think it had anything to do with genres or influences. I think it was just our particular creative chemistry. I mean, yeah, I love the Beatles. They're kind of a major foundation, but the way I'm wired, even though the Beatles are huge because they were numero uno, I mean, you know, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Igor Stravinsky, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis, Merle Haggard, Johnny Cash, it's all the same in my head. It really is. My influences are enormous.
He's very ecumenical in his taste, and I'm not quite as, but I'm pretty ecumenical in my taste. You know, I like to hear Miles Davis followed by George Jones any day of the week.
Yeah. Yeah, you compare the records you were making alongside some contemporaries, you know, Lyle Lovett, Steve Earle, people like that in the 80s, and those don't sound like the country records they're making today out of that industry. Your perspective on what's coming out of Nashville as country music right now, do you recognize it? Do you appreciate it? Do you like it?
There are some artists I like. I think Dierks Bentley is tremendously talented. And because I'm not clued in, I didn't really know what a lot of these people sounded like. It seems more anthemic to me, like, you know, anthemic pop songs. And I'm not dissing it. It is what it is. It's like everybody can coexist in my mind. I just don't know much about it.
Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift?
Pro or con?
They're just trying to get you to say
I think she's tremendously talented, and I think she's been a great role model for young women.
Yeah. Are you guys going to play another song for us? What are we going to hear?
This song is about an area of Arkansas that is known as the Sunken Lands, and it's called the Sunken Lands because in the New Madrid earthquake of 1811, the land around the Mississippi actually sank by 15 feet, and the Mississippi flooded the plain. And you would think it would make the soil very easy to till, but it didn't. They named it gumbo soil because it was so sticky and hard. But in this area of Arkansas, In 1935, FDR created a colony as part of the WPA program for 500 desperately poor families, and the Cash family was one of those families. And the hero of this song is my grandmother, Carrie Cash, who raised 7 children, picked cotton, was married to a man who was unkind. And she said when they moved into the cottage, there were 5 empty cans of paint in the front room of a home that was their salvation.
Cans of paint in the empty fields, and the dust reveals the children cry, the work never ends. There's not a single friend.
The Sunken Lands on XBN here, Sound Opinions with Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal. The song just reeking of the South, you know? The space, the geography of that area, you know, informed your music, informed your father's music. I'm interested in, Roseanne, your the way you've carried forward that enormous legacy. I know it's a double-edged sword in a lot of ways, but with the list in 2009, the record you do with John, where you address some of the great songs that your father passed down to you, said, "Hey, you got to learn these songs. These are great songs." And the beautiful memoir that you wrote, composed in 2010, where you talk about your father's legacy in many ways and the influence on your life. Do you feel in any way, because there's so much about your father that's been written and stuff has been recorded, people have talked about him, do you feel in any way that you've got to get the story right for people so that they'll know?
No.
Is that any?
No. That is such a frustrating occupation. When I was younger, I felt like, but that's not how it was. That's not how it happened. That's not who he is. You know, the tendency to mythologize him or make him bigger than a human being. His humanity is actually the most compelling part of who he was. And so I realized at some point that is not my job. People are going to project their ideals and opinions and agendas on him no matter what I would say. But at that time I realized if I don't at least tell my own story, that also could be co-opted someday. So that's why I wrote my memoir. And it's part of why we recorded the list. I felt like this is an enormous, beautiful legacy he's given me. It's, you know, it's past the sell-by date for me not to claim this in a gracious way and really integrate it.
I've seen some really fascinating quotes of you, Roseanne, talking about myth. You had to come to terms at some point with the fact that your father created that myth and it was part of the art. So when your kids come to you, or maybe they never do, but on rare occasions when they say, okay, all right, you know, what was he really like? Or, you know, did he like chocolate milk on his Cheerios? Or what? I mean, what's the, like, how do you, to them, in such an intimate way, tell them about Grandpa?
Salted peanuts and buttermilk. How's that?
says it all,
is
right?
Is that true? Wow.
Or was it salted peanuts and Coke? Salted peanuts and Coke, that's a real Southern thing to do. They all, except for my son, who was too young, he was 4 when my dad died, but even he has some memories, you know, of his grandpa teaching him how to use a typewriter and things like that. But my girls have their own memories, and I find out things from them, you know, that grandpa said this, or this special thing about grandpa means something to them that maybe I had no idea. So it's not that I'm handing them box of memories or, you know, a complete picture. They have their own.
You were a bit reluctant about this early on too, right? I mean, you wanted to stay as far away from it as possible.
Sure.
When you were a kid, right?
Of course. But that's true of any young person. You end up going into a field your parent is really successful in. You got to push away to find out who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I did a little longer than was necessary.
But you were, you know, the writing part of it, and you have become a fine writer. Is there a part of you that's saying, you know what, it was a lot of, I kind of wish I'd stuck with that original vision. This turned out to be different than I expected. I mean, is there ever days that you have like that?
You mean about not being a performer, just
right,
being a writer? Yeah, you know, sometimes that happens in baggage claim. Like, I go, if I see one more baggage claim, I'm going to go postal. Like, I want to just be at home in my cave writing. But I love this. I mean, there's nothing that replaces a connection with the audience and the energy exchange, and we do something for each other, you know?
And this internet thing hasn't replaced that.
No, never will.
Oh, we got it. Now only we open up that can of worms. Does everybody follow Roseanne on Twitter? Because she's really good. What do you like about it? What is it? What has made it worthwhile enough for you to continue to do and continue to pursue over these last bunch of years?
Well, I didn't get on Twitter to promote anything. I got on because it's a forum and there were people I knew, and it was like this big virtual cafe society to me. And I met, quote, e-met people up there. Really interesting people. We had conversations, and they were brief conversations, mm-hmm, which was very appealing to me. And I have a lot of kinetic energy, and it was a place to take it. So my husband was happy. I wasn't always putting it on him, you know, all of these ideas and conversations. And as my friend Mike Doty, who's a fantastic songwriter, said, it's like boot camp for songwriters. If you can say it succinctly, poetically sometimes, in 140 characters, that's helpful.
Is there anything on the river and the thread that started as a tweet?
That's so interesting you're asking that, because I'm glad to have the opportunity to say this. There's this man who follows me. I think he's a musician, but he might not be. I don't know him. He's Scottish. And I don't remember why we had this back and forth. It was something about Scottish aphorisms. And he said, you know, there's this great Scottish aphorism. He said it shortly because it was Twitter. You ask me about my drinking, but you don't ask about my thirst. And I said, that is so beautiful. And I took it and twisted it a little and put it in the song World of Strange Design. Wow. I said, we talk about your drinking, but not about your thirst. And when he heard, I had forgotten that he told me that aphorism because I looked it up on the internet. And then when this record came out, he goes, do you remember I told you that?
Is he angling for a songwriting credit?
We talk about your drinking, but not about your thirst. You set off through the minefield like you were rounding first. So open up a window and hand the baby through. Point her towards a ghostly bridge and she'll know what to do.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and we are here, not in our usual studio, but at WXPN with Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal. Thank you so much, guys, for being on Sound Opinions.
Thank you. Our real pleasure.
To watch videos of Roseanne Cash and John Leventhal, or to catch up on previous episodes of the show, visit our website, soundopinions.org. And share your thoughts on Roseanne Cash or anything in the musical universe. Call 888-859-1800. Coming up, we review the latest from California singer-songwriter Jenny Lewis.
Son of rhythm, brother of the blues. The sound of darkness, the pull of the oak. Everything is broken and painted in smoke.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that is a song called Just One of the Guys by Jenny Lewis from her third proper solo album, The Voyager. We don't often comment on videos, Greg, but there's a remarkable one for that with Anne Hathaway and Kristen Stewart joining Jenny Lewis. Jenny's had several phases in her career. She was a child actress early on, and then she chose to devote herself to music. Rilo Kiley, a wonderful power pop band, got a lot of attention. She also started her solo career with 2006 album Rabbit Fur Coat. She was a guest on Sound Opinions around that time. Followed that record up. In between, worked as a duo, Jenny and Johnny, with her boyfriend Jonathan Rice, has sung with the Postal Service. It's been some time, though, since we got another solo album from Jenny Lewis. It's been years. During that time, she underwent several periods of stress. Her estranged father passed away. Rilo Kiley broke up. She suffered a bout with insomnia. All of these emotional travails went into the songwriting, and she got some impressive producers to help her make this album, The Voyager, mainly Ryan Adams, working with her in his analog studio, but also the track that we bumped in with, Just One of the Guys, produced by Beck. What is Jenny Lewis giving us on this disc? We're going to play the title song of The Voyager by Jenny Lewis on Sound Opinions.
By the time I got your letter, I lost my mind. I was tripping. When you're getting better, it's a jagged line.
That's The Voyager, the title track from Jenny Lewis's third solo record. I love that track, Jim.
Quite a song.
And it reflects on that jagged line, as she calls it, to recovery. All this turmoil that you were talking about, all of that is in these songs. She's not talking specifically about herself, but these characters, these narrators, are going through some hell on earth, as it were, and it's in those songs. Now, you wouldn't notice it at first, because this is very much a 70s California record. I mean, she grew up out there. These songs, these sounds were in her mother's record collection. She grew up listening to Laurel Canyon pop and some of those Fleetwood Mac records from the late 70s. That's in her musical DNA, and you can really hear it here as well. There's almost a deceptive smoothness about this record. I think you could play this as background music at a wine bar, and nobody would be disturbed, you know? And I think that's the only real fault I can find with it, because it's beautiful music, beautifully sung, and really poignant in moments like that title song. But when you dig a little deeper and you recognize what these songs are about and what these characters are going through, the music almost feels like a balm for this. And her voice has exactly the soothing quality that's required. This is the third solo record by Jenny Lewis. All of them have been better than anything she's done with Rilo Kiley, as far as I'm concerned. This is a buy-it record for me.
I would agree, Greg. This is a buy-it record, but I started out by thinking it was a trash-it record. You know, one of our big sources of disagreement is your love for Fleetwood Mac, to whom I have a complete antipathy. There's a little bit too much smoothness here, but this woman is writing about things that I can't recall many other people of our generation writing about. You know, when she sings in Just One of the Guys about, I haven't had a baby and I refuse to be defined by not choosing to have a baby. I mean, that's really brave territory. You don't hear stuff like that, or going into, you know, failed relationships and how they haunt her and you can't outrun them. There's some really great songwriting here, and I began to understand that the depth and the emotion and the sometimes acerbic wit of the lyrics almost need that syrupy saccharine California sound to balance them. This is like the very best of the Beach Boys, the heck with Fleetwood Mac. So it grew on me, but I had to get over the slickness of it. When I finally did, I came down firmly, like you did, on a box it for this record. What do we have on the show next week?
Jim, next week we're going to pay tribute to Tommy Ramone, the great Ramones drummer who recently died, in a conversation about the great Ramones album Rocket to Russia.
Greg, we want to thank Adam Yaffe and everyone at WXPN for helping us with the Roseanne Cash recording. Sound Opinion's senior producers are Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. Our production assistant is Anthony Martinez, and our intern is Sam Taylor.
Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Hi, my name is Dan, and I'm calling from Chicago, and I had a comment to make about This Is Spinal Tap. I saw This Is Spinal Tap in Edinburgh, Scotland, and I had no idea that the people in it were not British, and I thought it was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen.
We came like babies from a home across the sea to see America and the people who opened up their arms to welcome us to America. We came like children from a far and distant land to see America. The golden sun, the freedom
filled it down to us in America. And the people stood and stared.
Around about the same time, I also saw Repo Man, and Alex Cox was there because it was part of the Edinburgh Film Festival, and there was a screening of it, and I happened to have wandered in, and Alex Cox was there, and someone in the front row said, "Is that what it's really like?" And Alex Cox said, "Yeah." And that's what I thought of Spinal Tap. I thought, that's what it's really like. Anyway, it was a fun period of time back there in 1984. Have a good day.
Hey, guys. This is Josh in Oakland, and I really enjoyed your conversation about Spinal Tap. Such an amazing movie. Another thing to discuss would be the movie The Ruddles, released in 1978. I don't think Spinal Tap would have been possible without the Ruddles. All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Travis calling from Ventura, California. In light of your review of the most recent Morrissey record, I thought that I would call in with my Morrissey joke. So Morrissey and Kanye West walk into a bar. 5 minutes later, Kanye walks out saying, "Man, that guy's a pretentious, self-aggrandizing egomaniac." Thank you. Have a great day.
When our friends become successful, we hate it when our friends become successful. Oh, look at those clothes. Now look at that face, it's so old. On such a video, well, it's really laughable.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.